Arte da ascoltare. Radio Papesse al Festival dell'Arte Contemporanea.
This is Richard Wentworth, artist from London.
Bruce Altshuler. I run the Museum Studies program at New York University and I research the history of exhibitions.
Li abbiamo incontrati a Faenza, dove insieme hanno discusso del lavoro di Wentworth, dell'idea di progresso e di quella di sviluppo. Per la nostra intervista gli abbiamo chiesto di raccontarci la loro prospettiva sui musei e sulle istituzioni del mondo dell'arte. E il risultato è stata una conversazione che intreccia le idee chiare e accademiche di Altshuler con l'esperienza diretta e suggestiva di Wentworth.
Well, I think there are a number of ways they've changed. One has to do with what people expect to happen at a museum. The traditional way of relating to a museum is that you go there, you see things, and you leave. You learn something, whatever. But increasingly, museums try and become places of experience of all kinds, not only of artworks, but where people can go as families, where people can go shopping, go to the store, where people can meet and see a movie. So there's a increasing emphasis for museums as sort of places of public gathering, rather than places just where you go and are taught something. There's also a new view on the part of the public as to what sort of museums can provide. Not only do they provide these various places of gathering, but they provide certain educational services for school children, for broader communities. So that's like one area. Another one has to do with contemporary art. 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, there were not that many museums of contemporary art. And traditional museums were not really concerned with contemporary art. Now there are contemporary art curatorial positions in most general museums, museums that used to just stop in the 1950s. Now they're collecting work of 2010. There is increasing public interest in contemporary art and in modern art. In part as a consequence of increased publicity around the cost of contemporary art, the involvement of contemporary artists with broader culture, with fashion, with music, etc. And another way in which museums have changed is a sort of need to and an interest in sort of engaging with contemporary art and contemporary artists. And that involves more than just collecting it, but commissioning projects, etc. There was talk of the museum as a site of production for contemporary art. This sort of thing really started around 1970. And then with the expansion of biennials and the sort of development of what people might think of as biennial cultures, the creation of large-scale projects by artists, more and more museums started becoming involved in the creation of artworks themselves, to the point where many contemporary curators really view their primary activity as one of working with artists, not selecting artworks, which was the old kind of curatorial role, but rather working with artists to facilitate their projects.
Not that I really care. I know a love.
I think that when I was a teenager, in the 60s, the museum was somewhere that was over there. I don't think I would ever have said the museum felt near. You wouldn't be in a museum by accident. It was a destination. I think it belonged to a very particular piece of the culture, and some people had the keys to it, others not. That's not a tidy picture either. You could come from different points in the culture and you might have access to the museum or not. So I don't mean to be speaking in cliches. I think that what Bruce is suggesting is that it's a much more urbanistic thing. It's much more, it is a much more open thing, but then the society is much more open. So I'm not sure I can separate them out very easily. everyone is wearing a garment made in China. Their watch is probably made in China. Their camera is probably imagined in, possibly in America, assembled in Thailand. So we're living in a time which may turn out not to last for very long, but we are living in a time of immense social shift, all sorts of mobility, lots of people with no mobility equally. And the museum is definitely part of the response mechanism. And it may even have provoked it a little bit, but I think it's much more responding. There's an English expression, butcher, baker, candlestick maker. So when I grew up, the world was a butcher, baker, candlestick maker culture, more or less, which is really 19th century. A street had a butcher, a baker, and, so to speak, a candlestick maker. And in the 60s, this dissolved into something very, very different for all sorts of reasons. And I think you can say that the butcher, baker, candlestick maker divisionism that you used to have in a museum has now dissolved also. That would include the musicians department. Well, I mean, obviously, I can only really offer, I can only easily offer a British model. And the British model was that, this is a little bit crude, but I would say that the museum was a little bit stuffy. It was a place of connoisseurship, which I respect. I mean, I understand that. It was quite rare to know somebody in a museum. I didn't know very many people who were involved in museums. And my first contact with museums actually really is in the early 80s through various people who I had known. I was starting to meet people who were at the edge of museums and were ambitious. And then they would start to ask me, could you come in? And maybe what was happening is that I was an instrument. I would be used as a kind of disturbance. To make a really cheap joke, I think in England, some people think that I might possibly be part of the establishment because I speak quite well. And I think sometimes I was used in that way. No one would ever say that. No one has ever said that to me. But I've often crossed my mind that perhaps I was a sort of fifth columnist, because actually I'm not going to conform to the to various internal stereotypes in a museum. And if I work with somebody in a museum, I obviously am very interested. I mean, it's delightful to get behind. It's always delightful to get behind, in English you say, behind the counter, where you change roles. And it's incredibly exciting. I got once was locked in the basement of the British Museum. I thought it was the most incredibly exciting event. You know, it's like being in some special sort of ghost film. There was a misunderstanding about who was coming back when, and they didn't come back, and I was left. You know, and the basement of the British Museum is a serious piece of underground real estate, you know. You know, the contents of a museum are not the list of what we call the unreturnable stolen goods. Go to the British Museum or the Victoria and Albert Museum or the Ashmolean in Oxford. How these things got in there is often questionable. So historical, they're narratives. They're safe, or they're probably as safe as they're ever going to be. There are very important questions of access, because maybe they were taken away from another culture or from other people. And I think there's a way in which the idea that those objects can be released, can be aerated by artists, or put in a new order, or in new relationships, is very exciting. And it reminds you that that's what modernity is, getting into an aeroplane at an airport and getting out somewhere else in a few hours' time, where the temperature is very different and people speak a different language and behave differently. That has only been known for not even a very large group of people, but it's only really been known for about 50 years, 40 years. And most people still have that. That's a strong sensation. And a museum, in some ways, can be a vehicle for reminding you of our conduct. I think conduct is a... I like the word conduct.
Well, I mean, I think people have become, you know, as a result of sort of a greater self-consciousness about contemporary culture, about the museum, about sort of what museums do, become more aware of the role of classifying and evaluating, but more classifying and kind of creating the categories according to which we would classify things that the museums are part of. And one sort of active area of artists' work with museums, really pioneered by the artist Fred Wilson, is to engage with existing museum collections and sort of through juxtaposition of objects, through rearrangements of collections, to tease out those the ways in which museums affect sort of how we look at the past and how we look at ourselves. Around issues of race, gender, history. So I think that's sort of one area of kind of contemporary artistic work in museums, interventions in museums, that, you know, it's been very sort of interesting and kind of very much in sync with kind of a more postmodern turn of thinking, the construction of basic categories of understanding of history in ourselves. And artists have employed museum collections sort of in order to sort of interrogate that. Well, I mean, there are many ways sort of any set of objects can be arranged and talked about. And the opportunities provided by new technologies, by podcasts, etc. So there are plenty of opportunities. I mean, in the 18th century was really the time when museum and royal collections began to be organized didactically for educational purposes. So you had the reorganization of the Habsburg collections, you know, according to kind of a chronological and regional division of the paintings and sculptures, Italian, French, German, arranged chronologically with labels. And the person that did this, Christian Eckel, you know, said he wanted to create a visible history of art. And that became the role of the museum, a didactic one, a teaching role. And then that became, though it remained historically structured, it became much more aesthetically oriented. And works and museums started to show less works displayed more, sort of with more room around them, around the idea of the masterpiece. With historical works sort of put down in a different part of the museum, but fewer works displayed to create kind of a still chronological, but a kind of aesthetic education highlighting works deemed of the highest quality. So there have been changes in the way museums themselves tell narratives. And then recently, the last 10 years, museums have become extremely self-conscious and self-aware in their narratives. So they're talking about the history of their own collections. And they are starting to sort of be self-critical in a way, I wouldn't say a deeply self-critical way, but a more self-aware way about where their collections came from, who the collectors were. In fact, I think to the degree where museums are sort of talking more about themselves than about the works in them. So you have this kind of dynamic between artists and alternative narratives and the narrative of the museum, and the museum itself becoming self-conscious, probably in a defensive way, to kind of, we're giving another self-conscious kind of deconstructive narrative, but it's the official one. Well, I mean, they want the same story. I mean, they want the story they tell themselves to be the story the public tells itself about them. So it's just, you know, education. I mean, they're trying to educate you. They're just doing it in a sort of you're being educated about the museum itself, not only the works in it. I mean, not only, I mean, they still do all the other things.
Listening to Bruce, I'm really conscious of something which I don't feel I'm really highly educated in, but it really a question of power. And I think it's very funny for us, for Bruce as an American and me coming from England, to be in a town like Faenza and to see these palazzi, so to see these substantial buildings of medium high to medium low, let's say, in class terms. But the expression of power is fantastic. And I like to be reminded of that. You know, the size of a door, it's more than trying to get the horse in. This is a serious object, this door. And then the sub-doors and the sub-doors. And all these feelings of who had access, who didn't have access. The codes that would be legible, who the people were who gave you access or didn't give you access, how we read each other, in fact, how we trust each other, which you experience even on a very elaborate modern street. You have a vigilance on the street or a reduced vigilance because you feel at ease, but actually you're in a kind of cultural space where sometimes you feel a little bit threatened, sometimes not at all. But it reminds you that you are part of a very elaborate power structure and you're in it and you are exercising it. And no doubt people have feelings about, you know, no one is going to meet me and not notice that I'm probably an older man. And it's not going to take them very long to find out that I'm English. So with these things come other things. Now, this is true in all cultural production. It's funny that we're beginning to live with objects which have almost no cultural origin. They're just the instruments. You know, the recording equipment today is just a generic silver object with green and red lights, which look very professional and look as if they were maybe... the design of them has been taken from a 747 cockpit or a spacecraft, but I recognize it's just a generic tool of recording equipment, and that applies to my telephone and many other things. And so there's this very funny thing about trying to locate ourselves culturally is what I'm trying to describe. And I think there's a sort of turmoil going on where we all know that all the rules have sort of fallen to pieces. Even empires feel very wobbly. Even the source of wealth which might back an empire feels very wobbly. So anyone with a grain of intelligence is thinking all the time, what are the terms of reference? And it's not surprising that it's expressed in the conduct of museums, because museums are the storehouses of cultural value. Well, I'm a chronicler, in a way, quite an irresponsible chronicler, but I have this idea that I might be producing an archive which will be completely extraordinary, because the person who made it, maybe, I don't want to make a comparison, but it's a quick one to reach for, someone like Eugène Ager, who made these photographs in Paris, but he said that he was just making documents. He said he was making them for people to use in the theatre as sort of reference images. And my pictures are not, they don't have any of that. I don't think that, in fact, I would say they have none of that grandeur. But they often are around territory that you can read in Ager very, very... You can see what a doorknob was like, and you can see what they did with the plants. You know a lot of stuff in a way that's completely different from looking at a genre painting. And I wonder if there isn't a sort of, whether I don't harbour, I mean, I have become very interested in history. And I wonder if I'm not doing something which is a slightly, is projecting into some kind of future. A domestic thing that happened to me quite recently, which was very affecting, was that I was with my mother and I looked at my grandfather's photo album with her. My mother's 88. And she was born in 1922 and she was born in China. And my grandfather was, for a short time, within the colonial project in Hong Kong. He worked for Shell. And this book has pictures of him in the First World War, very young man. I mean, terrifying thought, you know, 19 years old, looking unbelievably handsome. I mean, looking 18th century in his uniform, with other men in uniform, somewhere in France. And the photograph has their names written, very nice handwriting, and each person has their name underneath in a very correct way, a sort of Edwardian way. And then under each one, it just goes, killed, killed, wounded, killed, wounded. And then there's him. And I was looking at it and I went, oh my God, that's how I can be here. If you're killed, it's probable that you won't have children. And I was wondering about his impulse. Why would he have put... Who was this for? This is written in 1922 or something. Why would he have written that? You know, it has no intimacy. It's just a report. Incredibly upsetting. But he's the person who... He was also wounded, but not wounded so badly that it mattered. And he doesn't... I don't think he writes under his name wounded. And it's one of those funny moments where you feel a very distinct, where culture and biology join up. You kind of go, oh my God, you know, we're somebody's children. And all culture is exactly that. That's what culture is. It's this little braid or, you know.
Hai appena ascoltato una produzione di Radio Papesse. Il servizio è gratuito, ma tutto quello che senti ha dei costi di produzione. Se vuoi aiutarci a sostenerli, vai sul sito www.radiopapesse.org e clicca su Sostieni. Basta davvero poco.